from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Canadian police say a video purportedly made by the disturbed young man who shot up that country's parliament building last week shows that his action was, in their words, ideologically and politically motivated. Police had already identified the attacker as Michael Zahaf Bibeau, a 32-year-old Quebec-born male who, according to media reports, was a recent convert to Islam who police say was planning to go to Syria. Authorities remain convinced that he acted alone. We have this report from Catherine Cullen from the Canadian news agency CBC News.
The RCMP say Michael Zahaf Bibeau made a video of himself. They won't make it public yet, but say it shows what they call ideological and political motives. CBC News has learned that in the video, he says he is acting because of Canada's foreign policy and praises Allah. A source familiar with the investigation says the video will likely be released in the next day or two. The RCMP are looking at who he talked to in the days before the shooting to see if that, quote, contributed or facilitated in any way the terrorist attack. Catherine Cullen, CBC News, Ottawa.
Brazil's incumbent president, Dilma Rousseff, gained the support of a clear majority of those who voted in this past Sunday's runoff election. We have this report from Telesur.
Dilma Rousseff has obtained more than 51% of the votes. Now, in typical Brazilian style, we've come to the family house of a resident here in Rio to watch the results come in on the television. And we have come to the house of João Ferres, professor of political science at Rio's State University. Thank you very much for having us. What is your initial analysis of these results?
Well, I like what you said about the typical Brazilian style, because as a matter of fact, Brazilians really cherish, you know, this democratic practice of elections. And I think that the results were predictable because, you know, Dilma led the polls almost throughout the whole campaign. So, you know, at the very end, at the beginning of the second turn of the elections, Aécio Neves, her contendant, actually had a small advantage over her. But then, you know, she again, you know, assumed leadership in the polls. And, you know, I think that the last polls already pointed to that result.
What about the fact that Dilma Rousseff has also won in the Minas Gerais state, where Aécio Neves is governor? What does that say?
Well, that's also predictable, because the results of the first turn show that not only Dilma, you know, beat Aécio in his own state. I mean, she was born there too, but, you know, he was the governor of that state. But also, you know, her candidate, PT, the Workers' Party candidate, won the governorship over there, over Aécio's, you know, candidate. So, you know, it was a double victory in the first turn. And now she just confirmed it.
What have been the obstacles for the Workers' Party in this electoral campaign? A lot of people have talked about manipulation on behalf of mainstream media. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, one of the main obstacles for the Workers' Party is actually to get its message through, you know, to the electorate, because the mainstream media in Brazil is very concentrated on the opposition, on the, you know, the right-wing side of the political spectrum. So what happens is that they're, you know, I do a study that's on a website called manchetometer.com, in which we analyze the bias of the big media, you know, in the elections. And it shows clearly that, you know, most of the big media enterprises have a huge bias against Dilma and the Workers' Party. So the Workers' Party had to work, you know, during the campaign against that bias. You know, and that's very hard, but they succeeded.
Talking to a lot of people here in Rio, they expect of Dilma's government to move forward with political reforms. One of them would be in communication, and one of them would be in the Congress. What are those challenges now?
Well, I think that people in Brazil have been talking a lot about political reform, but there is no consensus about what type of political reform should be enacted. And it's not very clear that, you know, there are about which point should be changed. And in my particular opinion, I think there are a few things that should be changed in the Brazilian political system, but, you know, not the main ones. So we have a proportional system that is working very, very well, I think, for you know, deputies. And we also, you know, the elections for president and mayors and governors, that's been working fine. So I don't think we need major changes. We need some changes in campaign financing, I think, and also in the coalitions for the elections of deputies and representatives.
What's going to happen with ASU Neves now?
What happens is that, you know, if you see what happened to PSDB, his party, which, you know, has been one of the most important parties in Brazil, one of the two most important parties in Brazil, I mean, in terms of presidential elections and in general terms, you know, in the last, I would say, you know, since 1998, or 94, as a matter of fact, you know, the contention, the main parties in the political system in Brazil, you know, vying for presidency have been PT, the Workers Party, and PSDB. But now PSDB is reduced, you know, they lost the presidency. So they reduced to the state of São Paulo, the state of Paraná, which is like a small state underneath São Paulo on the map, and also two other, you know, not very important states. So, you know, they have become a regional party, and already in the Chamber of Deputies, you know, they're like a middle-range party. So I think that their importance in Brazilian politics has been dwindling over the years, and I don't know what's going to happen with them.
With these electoral results, what is the message to the world? I mean, because what's happening in Brazil is extremely important, not only for this country, but also for Latin America and important economic groups such as BRICS. So what is this message that Brazil has given today to the world?
I think the message is very clear, because what we had here in Brazil is a confrontation between two very different projects. You know, one is a neoliberal project that ASU Neves and PSDB represented, right? Cutting governmental spending, you know, not caring a lot about employment and workers' wages. And PT represents the opposite. So PT, I mean, the Workers' Party, Dilma and Lula, work with the assumption that it's very important for the state to invest in the economy and to protect wages and employment. So, and that's a model that has been working in Brazil for a number of years. So I think that Brazil works an example for the rest of the world, particularly for Europe, where, you know, actually you have orthodox economic policies being applied, and the whole continent has been in crisis since, I think, 2008. So Brazil, I think, works like this counterexample that is doing fine. So that's what it is.
Well, thank you very much, Joel Fedders, for having us in your house and for receiving these electoral results with you. Well, it's definitely been a roller coaster ride here in Brazil, but that's it. That's how it is. Dilma Rousseff is now the next president of Brazil. I'm Stephanie Kennedy here in Rio de Janeiro.
Meanwhile, Uruguay's presidential election will go to a second round, with the leftist candidate leading the three-way contest with 49.4%. Just shy of the majority needed. However, his party, the Broad Front, won a parliamentary majority, which means they will not need to negotiate with other parties to pass legislation should they win the presidency in the second round. With 98% of ballots counted as of Monday, Broad Front candidate Tabari Vazquez leads going into the second round of voting with 49.4%, a stronger result than polls had predicted. Vazquez's nearest rival, Lacalle Pou of the National Party, received 32%, and Pedro Bordaberry of the Colorado Party was third with 13.4%. The runoff is scheduled for November 30th. Elections were held in Ukraine as well, at least in the western half of the country, but the fact that the millions of voters who live in the eastern half of the country boycotted the vote was somehow completely missed by Ukrainian media, which reported a 99.9% turnout. RT was monitoring Kiev's TV news and provided this report.
Since the two eastern regions, Donetsk and Lugansk, are battling for autonomy from Kiev, they mainly boycotted the vote. And we are talking about several million people here. But viewers across Ukraine saw these figures on their screens on national television. According to them, the turnout across the entire country, including the east, was a massive 99.9%. The voting was also shown to have taken place in the Russian territory of Crimea. Apparently some unfortunate technical glitch to blame on that.
Marcus Papadopoulos is the executive editor of the British news magazine Politics First. He covered Sunday's election in Ukraine and spoke with RT Monday.
Ukraine's elections were a total and utter farce and an insult to so much of the Ukrainian population. Ever since the Western-backed coup this February in Ukraine, the pro-Western government of President Poroshenko has rolled back democracy in the country. The two traditionally dominant political forces in southeastern Ukraine, the Party of Regions and the Communist Party of Ukraine, have effectively been destroyed as political forces in the country. They have been singled out as traitors. They have been referred to as agents of Moscow. They have been expelled from the Ukrainian parliament. They've been subjected to violence and intimidation. And so it's little surprise that millions of Ukrainians in South Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, chose not to vote. They chose not to vote because their traditional parties were not on the ballot paper. And they're also very fearful. If we take the Communist Party of Ukraine, its leader, Petro Symonenko, at the beginning of this year, his home was set on fire by ultra-nationalist mobs. Now, you won't hear about that in Western media. Certainly the BBC never referred to that because it doesn't fit in to the West's narrative of what's happening in Ukraine. So only on paper does Ukraine have democracy. In reality, it is very selective, and it is only for those parties in the country which are pro-Western.
Hong Kong police have arrested 11 people on charges of fighting in public and assaulting officers. The chief superintendent of the police's public relations bureau has once again called for all citizens to express their opinions peacefully and rationally. We have this report from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
The chief superintendent of the police's public relations bureau reported the Saturday arrests at his news conference. Hui Chuntak also said more violent incidents also took place. He again called on all citizens to express their opinions peacefully and rationally. Hui stressed that Hong Kong is a society ruled by law and that no one can be above it or use unlawful means to vent their discontent. The chief superintendent said that some Occupy Central protesters are continuing to illegally build and consolidate the street barricades in the Mong Kok district, and he expressed concern that the situation at the occupied sites could deteriorate further.
The Mong Kok district has now become a very dangerous place. Large-scale conflicts may occur at any time there. When emergency happens, when the street barricades are toppled, can you imagine what consequence will incur? When somebody gets hurt, it can be very difficult for rescuers to arrive because of the barricades. It will hamper the effort to save people's lives.
Meanwhile, counter-protesters in the city have gathered more than 500,000 signatures on their petitions seeking an end to the protests. This past Friday, Black Agenda Report held its annual fundraiser and get-together at the historic Riverside Church in New York City. Executive editor Glenn Ford was one of the many prominent speakers at the event.
The overall theme of this evening, I suppose, is Ferguson, with an emphasis on naming the names of what we call the Black misleadership class, or at least describing them. And there are six of us who will be speaking in general to that topic. Actually, the topic has a wide range of possibilities, but I'm the first one, so welcome to this discussion. Most of the folks that I know are working on the proposition, or maybe it's not a proposition, it's a hope, that Ferguson, Missouri, what's happened there, may signal an important historical juncture for Black people in the United States. And I think that there's very good reason to believe that that is the case. And I know that if we behave and if we work and if we discipline ourselves, then this can really become the kind of pivotal time in history that many of us have been working towards for a very, very long time. What makes Ferguson important is that the people refused to stand down when they were confronted with the raw intimidating power of a Gestapo-like police, a militarized police. They stood their ground. Michael Brown's murder was nothing out of the ordinary. It was an ordinary event in this horror show called the United States. The horror is in the ordinariness of Michael Brown's murder, in the everydayness of it, in the business as usualness of his murder. But the people of Ferguson's response was something out of the ordinary. And that's why we are speaking in terms of Ferguson being some kind of pivotal point today. They're the ones who created the focal point of rage. And they created the political space, and they created the political opportunity for the nation and the world to take notice, and for people who are activists to get busy. They're the ones who said, come, look at this barbaric murder. You've got to respond to this. You are summoned, you are compelled to come here and deal with this. The people of Ferguson showed that they were ready for struggle, that they were prepared to stand up to the police, to stand up to the armed state. And so it was a challenge, in fact, to us. Many of us thought that it could not happen, but the people of Ferguson challenged us. Since nobody thinks that the people of Ferguson, Missouri, are all that different from black folks anywhere else in this country, that means that our folks in general may be ready to engage in organized resistance to this mass black incarceration state after 40 years of being under its boot. And that is something that is historically very significant. Some of us wishful ones, are wishful enough to think that Ferguson signals an end to the self-imposed passivity and the quietude that has characterized black America in the age of Obama, which is now 6 years in and running. Obama, however, is on his way out. And that means a lot more than the fact that there will not be this black icon in the White House. He goes out having demonstrably done nothing of substance for black America. And in fact, he has presided over an unmitigated economic and social disaster that has itself resulted in so many black bodies in the streets, and with cops looking like and behaving like US Marines in Fallujah. That is the Obama legacy. There's a large segment of our people, and by large I mean enough of them to make a movement or the beginnings of one. A large segment of our people have concluded that it's time to go back to the streets. That's part of what makes this an historic and pivotal moment. But we will not do right by the people. We will not seize this watershed moment if we are not armed with a proper analysis of where we are, if we don't do it scientifically, as Brother Yesha Taylor was speaking, if we don't apply all of the lessons that we have learned, and I don't mean as individuals, but collectively, in this long struggle that we've been engaged in the United States. There is a general understanding, certainly in the wake of Ferguson, that the police act as an occupying army in black America. But the Black Panther Party and others were saying that 45 years ago, and two generations have passed since much of black America and its allies came to that conclusion. This is old news, yet we have gone through from just one SWAT team in the country back in 1969, and that was in Los Angeles, to a whole nation of SWAT teams. There are 80,000 SWAT team raids a year in the United States. That is how far we have fallen, and we have not made the required noise and motion to stop that kind of velocity. The question is, what happened in the 45 years between 1969, when the Los Angeles headquarters of the Black Panther Party was raided by that first SWAT team? What happened between then and now, 2014? The militarization of the police grew by leaps and bounds. The black prison population grew probably tenfold since that time. But active resistance to the black mass incarceration state and to police militarization has not been up front and center in the black American political conversation during that period, even though those are the most important things that were happening to us. Instead, black people have been told to be most concerned about the upward mobility of a small segment of our society, the most fortunate segment of black society. It's a kind of trickle-down theory. If they get everything that they want, and they seem to want everything, some of it may trickle down to us. Who's been leading that conversation? Who has misdirected our people's concentration away from the two greatest challenges that face us? And those two challenges are mass black incarceration and gentrification, which is closing the window on black majority cities and even large plurality black cities all across the country. The who is the black misleadership class. We coined that term here at Black Agenda Report. This is the class that profits from the massive state repression that shut down and murdered and threw into prison the voices that told us back in 67 and 68 and 69 that the police were an occupying army and that they need to be ejected from our communities. This was the class that counseled black folks in the early 70s that mass movement politics was passé and that liberation came from voting the straight Democratic Party ticket, and that independent black politics and radical politics in general was an unsophisticated approach to power. And of course, none of us wanted to be unsophisticated. What I maintain, and I think this is shared by most of us, if not all of us at Black Agenda Report, is that the internal struggle, especially at this stage of the game, is a primary struggle. That we understand, many of us, the dimensions of this capitalist state under conditions of decay and what it is willing to do to us. What we do not have clear in our heads, and I'm talking, when I say our, I mean activists. What is not clear in our heads is how we deal with this black misleadership class, which acts in collaboration with those powers that be, that voted 80% of them, I'm talking about the Congressional Black Caucus now, 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to continue Pentagon transfers of weapons and military gear to local police. 4 out of 5, and this is representative of the collaboration of this class. We have to come to grips with how we isolate and replace them in terms of leadership in black America, or else we will not have seized the time. Thank you.
The unrest in and around St. Louis, Missouri continues in the wake of the recent police shootings there. Marsha Coleman Abadayo discussed the case of Vonderit Myers, killed by St. Louis police on October 8th. She spoke with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar.
The Vonderit Myers case is such an important case, and it's important for a number of reasons, not only because a young man who was, you know, was shot down, murdered, man was shot down, murdered in the prime of his life by St. Louis police, that in and of itself is an important story. But I think what sets this story apart from some of the other stories, whether it's Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown or Sean Bell, is that the media seems now to really have a handle on these stories. And they're beginning to demonize the victims of these terrorist acts at a much quicker pace than we've ever seen them move before. So in many ways, Vonnegut Meyer's case has been a tipping point for the media. Before the young man was dead, 24 hours, the media was told. I mean, not the media, but the public was told that this guy was a bad apple, and basically good riddance. They were told that he was in an ankle bracelet because of a previous problem or brush that he had with the law. We were told that he was a troubled youth, that he, you know, he just had all kinds of issues. So even before we're able to find out about this guy, the media, it seems now, has a very clear paradigm in terms of how it wants to tell these stories. We've never seen them act this quickly before. So they wanted to make sure that before people understood that 10 minutes before he was murdered, Vonnegut Meyer was actually in a local deli, you know, just having fun with his friends. He had just bought a turkey sandwich. He was literally, you know, peeling off and tearing off corners of his turkey sandwich and giving it to his friend. And the shopkeeper, as I said, was quite comfortable with these guys being in the store and just having fun as young men.
Although the halls of America's prisons can serve to silence the most resolute voices, one person behind the walls in particular has projected so much power beyond the walls of the gulag that the jailers have to keep changing the law to silence him.
Another Mumia rule. Anyone even remotely familiar with my case knows about the Mumia rule. That's when the court or agency changes its rule or precedent to go against me. When Amnesty International wrote about my case, that was its essential focus, that laws and precedents that applied to other cases would be changed when it came to me. In fact, when my habeas corpus case went before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, one judge, in dissent, Judge Ambrose, said, essentially, I know of no reason why we don't apply our precedents to Abu Jamal. There was one reason. The Mumia Rule. Now the Mumia Rule has been enacted into law, the so-called Victim Revictimization Act, signed into law by unconstitutional Tom, Pennsylvania's governor, Tom Corbett. What makes this remarkable is that Corbett, the former attorney general, knows perfectly well that this is an unconstitutional law in violation of the First Amendment to the Constitution. He knows this, for he's a lawyer, and he also knows that an unconstitutional law is no law at all. Interestingly, he's so much a politician that he was busy running for governor when, under his very nose, children were being raped and abused in the Penn State scandal. As attorney general, he was on Penn State's board of trustees at the time. These rapes and molestations were happening, and did next to nothing until the scandal broke. Oh, he reportedly received a generous campaign contribution from the chairman of the board and members of the foundation run by Jerry Sandusky, the central figure in the Penn State scandal. Nice job, Tom. Too busy picking up campaign contributions to protect the kids? Every politician and every lawyer who supported this so-called law did so by knowingly violating their oath of office to protect and defend the Pennsylvania Constitution, Article 1, Section 7, and the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. They took an oath to honor the Constitution, not their campaign contributors. They took an oath to protect the constitutional rights of all Pennsylvanians, not just their funders, the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Pigs. By violating their oaths, they bring disrepute on their oaths and their office. By signing a law they knew to be unconstitutional, they departed from the realm of lawmakers and became legislative outlaws. They passed the Mumia Rule, yes, But the damage they have done is greater to themselves than to me. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.